Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. As a Lebanese-American boy growing up in the dunes along Lake Michigan's southern shore, where school is excruciating and symptoms of neurodivergence are diagnosed as disabilities, Gary Paul Nabhan finds refuge and revelation in the natural world. In college, he gravitates to the thinkers now associated with the dawn of ecology as a discipline. He writes poetry, travels to Ecuador and Sonora, Mexico, where he first encounters the indigenous communities that will come to play a significant role in his life and work. His interest in earth-based spiritual practices leads him to take vows as an ecumenical Franciscan brother. Late in life, he returns to the land of his Arab ancestors, where he discovers a vision of kinship and climate resilience. Finally, when construction of the southern border wall begins, he collaborates with religious leaders to affirm indigenous rights to sacred places threatened by construction. Gary Paul Nabhan is a celebrated ethnobotanist and biocultural conservationist. His work has advanced ecological restoration, pollinator recovery, and indigenous food revitalization. He's authored dozens of books and been awarded the MacArthur Genius Grant. Now, in his book, Water in the Desert, he traces the fascinating story of his life. Gary Paul Nabhan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. I'm grateful to be with you and your listeners all over Utah.
Maybe let's start there. Your connections, several connections to Utah. Tell me, I guess, about your earliest forays into Utah.
Well, I was lucky enough to work at the first Earth Day headquarters in 1970. As a 17-year-old, and about the time that Earth Day happened, I needed a break, and six of us packed into a station wagon and drove to the newly formed Canyonlands National Park before it was really with its visitor centers and all of that. And we backpacked for 5 days, and that was sort of a wonderful aha moment of falling in love with deserts similar to where my grandparents came from in the Middle East. And it had a pull on me that eventually brought me to the West.
Then you've spent time in what has become Bears Ears, right? Colorado River as well.
That's right. I sort of had a spiritual revelation after backpacking with the Udall cousins and other people that at Prescott College, Arizona. I had a three-day fast up at 7,500 or 8,000 feet where animals were coming to take food out of my hand, and I stayed silent for 3 days. And so the Bears Ears area has always felt sacred to me, and I'm grateful to a landscape, if you can possibly be grateful not just to people but to landscapes. That is one that I just hold in my heart.
Of course, people will be familiar with your books and your work. This special book, I think for a lot of people who read your books, because you tell a bit of the story of your life, Water in the Desert, a Pilgrimage. Tell me a bit about so it's Lebanese American family, right? You talk about your grandparents and even before them, very colorful characters. It seems like incredible people.
Well, that's right. And I'm not trying to single out, Lebanese and Syrian Americans of having sort of, collective ethnic identity. I don't want to do any stereotypes, but there was just this incredible feeling of extended family in the way they raised me. And I think that spilled over to thinking of plants and animals as part of that extended family. My grandfather would butcher lambs for holidays in the threshold of the door, our front door, much to the horror of our neighbors. He was always whipping tahini oils and lemon juice to make sauces for the fish that we caught in Lake Michigan. And it was a very sort of earthy, in-your-body family that I think taught me how to be in my own culture, but respect other cultures too. And I think it it allowed me to accept how distinctive every culture in America is in the way they approach life and our landscapes.
Your grandfather, you say, whatever the reason, the white-haired grandfather enlisted me to be his confidant and business consultant. Which sounds fun. And then go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, Papa Ferhat, grandfather was a fruit peddler, and when he came home after a discouraging day, when people didn't buy what he thought were perfectly ripe fruit that they thought were mushy, he'd talk to me as if I were his business consultant, like, what should I do about this, son? How do I tell them that this is the perfect time to eat the fruit, that it's not something that you have to throw in the garbage can when they get mushy? So he gave me my love of fruits and vegetables as well.
I'll just read this sentence. I learned from Papa to love edges and boundaries where lakes and dunes dance together cheek to cheek. And that's been a theme in your work. Ecotones is, we could maybe have you define that.
Yes, an ecotone is the special zone of overlap between two distinctive habitats, or even cultures for that matter. And a lot of this book is not like my other books that focus exclusively on deserts, but the liminal space between deserts and seas, two of the most extreme environments in many ways in the world, but with hidden riches in both of them. And he would drive his fruit truck right down the edge of the splashing waves of the Lake Michigan shoreline, because the sand was actually more compact there. He let the airs out of the tile, and we just careened down the shorefront, scaring up shorebirds and waves splashing over the hood of the truck. And that excitement of being in this liminal space that's on the edge of two very divergent environments and realms, really, just won me over. And I've been interested in those places, and even orphan spaces, nature caught in the midst of cities and industrial dumps and all of that ever since.
What where do you think that fascination comes from for you?
Well, I think my family as a whole were edge walkers. They love that thin space between Arab culture and American culture. That made them kind of changelings, that they would, my aunts would do what African-American women do, passing powder up for certain occasions so that they looked white. But inside our homes, they were speaking Arabic and eating Arabic food. And I think that thing that we all have the capacity to be shapeshifters, and that there's fun in that, and also perils, that for anyone who's a thrill seeker, the perils are part of the fun. And I think I grew up not only loving to be in natural ecotones, but on cultural edges, doing cross-cultural work. And now I realize all of us live in a multicultural world. There's none of us that are virtually isolated to a single culture, and that we all have to learn how to be good allies in those intercultural spaces.
And that can be difficult, can it? There's a later chapter we'll get into, the trying to heal the land from the building of the southern border wall. You said there's nothing more difficult than trying to find consensus in a multicultural setting.
That's right. It takes incredible patience, respect for other cultures and their way of processing things and making decisions. I've been in meetings till 2 a.m. in indigenous villages, where the conversation just went around the circle till everyone reached consensus on an issue of concern to everyone in a village, rather than taking a vote and saying, well, it's 53-47 you who voted 47 lose in the way that we do cross-cultural work. We hope that no one loses, but everyone gains.
I guess there are lessons for all of us there, right? That patience, make sure everybody's voice is heard.
Of course, patience is an irony for me because growing up neurodivergent, early diagnosed with what we now call ADHD and Asperger's and other things I don't need to mention, I was impatient in ways. I was trying to put pieces of the puzzle together before all the puzzles were before me. And working across culture, across cultures, and I think doing a lot of skin diving and scuba diving taught me the little patience that I have.
Let's talk about that neurodivergence. I don't know if that word was even around when you were growing up, but you didn't speak as much. You drew, right? You would disappear into the dunes you would jog for hours. You said that some of the ways that manifest you trying to deal with what you didn't know what it was, right? Neither did the doctors.
That's right. I'm not very happy about labels anyway, and it always seemed to me that the psychologists and counselors that my parents could afford and that I later met only had tentative diagnostics. It really didn't say much about who I really was, but that I had elements of all of those things can't be denied. And that places a burden on people around me, of course. So it creates social tensions because you're sitting next to someone in the chair, but you're not looking at the world in the same way, and you have different tolerance levels and different ways of taking in information about the world. So it always makes you feel different, just as people who come into this country that are from another ethnic or racial background may be able to dance to the mainstream culture, but inside they always feel detached from it.
So you went out into the dunes, right, along Lake Michigan. Tell me about that. It seems like fascinating land.
Yeah. I mean, I never finished high school. I don't even have a GED. And I always say that my education was from playing hooky. And we weren't in the part of the Midwest where there are cornfields. It was out the back door was Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, was non-arable sand dunes and marshes and thick forests. And so I could really take refuge out there in hidden spaces where the truant officers couldn't find me. But that allowed me to be alone and hear and smell and take in the complexity of natural landscape season after season in a way that just deeply touched me and reworked who I was and calmed me down to some extent. I mean, I grew up during the heart of the chaos of the civil rights era in the Milltown that was my family's home, and in the midst of the Vietnam War and all the protests. So to have a refuge early on set me up for wanting to see that everyone had some kind of refuge, whether in an urban setting or a wilderness setting, wherever they live. And that's what a lot of my conservation work has been about, not what I would call elitist spaces, but places where even the poorest of the poor can find refuge.
Fascinating to me that I think your junior year in high school, you fell gravely ill. Kind of mysterious, right? It had no energy at all. But that kind of crystallized, I think, in your mind that you couldn't be without the more than human world. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, yes. I mean, any of us who have an illness that takes us through months of being bedridden or at hospitals or other kinds of caregiving situations, you know, we end up suffering a certain kind of claustrophobia. And I was just in hospitals three times the last week, and I felt that that immediate sense of being claustrophobic never goes away for the day, I mean, the moment I step into a hospital. But I just woke up one morning and I felt that the shroud of the illness had fallen, and I went out naked into a little tiny remnant of a wetland behind our house and just covered myself with mud, which I now know is full of the beneficial microbes that many of us need to overcome certain illnesses. And I instinctively do it like a beat up tomcat goes and just lays in the mud until his wounds heal. And so some of this, I think, is intuitive. I'm not exceptionally brilliant about these things. I just follow my nose. And that took me out the back door of our house naked to cover myself with mud to start my life over again.
You feel like you started your life over again at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of us have those pivotal experiences in their life. So this book really isn't about me, but it's about how we find solace in our connections to other organisms and cultures. And for me, the places that are muddy and stinky, not from pollution, but from the kinds of lack of oxygen that they have in their muds, have always drawn me. You know that they're microbial rich, and it's sort of this sense of fertility is all around you. And even though you can't name the microbes or the little insects and worms and larvae in the mud around you and smushed up on your legs, you know that you're not alone and that somehow you have a relation with the unnameable.
But you did dedicate this book to microbes.
That's right. I mean, again, I've done work in collaboration with microbial biologists the last two dozen years. I'm not a microbiologist, but I think ecology is flipped where we now, you know, really know that it's the little things that run the world. And I can't look at any plant without thinking of its microbial interactions that do everything to governing its flowering time and its fragrances, to repelling potential enemies or predators. So the microbes help with its defenses. And of course, they speed its growth and aid its resilience to stresses.
Let's take a break. We're talking with Gary Paul Nabhan. His new book is called Water in the Desert, A Pilgrimage. And it's out and available now. We'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I went looking for water in the desert and found that the world was teaching me how to listen. That's a quote from Gary Paul Nabhan, our guest for today's celebrated ethnobotanist and biocultural conservationist. He's out with the latest books called Water in the Desert, A Pilgrimage. In it, he traces the fascinating story of his life. So a lot of autobiography in here, Gary Paul Nabhan, but they're larger themes that you're hitting on. What are some of the big themes that you hope people get out of the book?
Well, I think two we've mentioned already, that in ways all of us are changelings and shapeshifters. We usually use terms for public figures like Bob Dylan or Robin Williams to use those terms for people in our own society. But every society I know of has stories about shapeshifters who turned themselves into animals and back again. And then that other theme is how all of us need to become good allies, not only with other forms of life, but with other cultures that deserve our solidarity. And to do that dance of learning how to interact cross-culturally, as you already alluded, is often a tough and trying exercise for everyone, not just someone coming into a community, but every player in those cross-cultural dialogues. And so a lot of the book is not really anything like an autobiography, but an ecography of those cross-cultural interactions and what we stand to gain in joy and laughter and love and heartbreak from being involved in such gorgeous interplays with beings unlike ourselves.
Tell me how you first encountered some indigenous communities. This has been a running theme through your work. Cross-cultural work in botany and other areas. What was your first encounter?
Well, I did have contact with an Indian herbalist, Native American herbalist in the Indiana Dunes, who helped my mother with some of her ailments. And I saw he had a different way of talking about the world and intrigued me. But those encounters where I lived in the Midwest, on Lake Michigan, were few and far between for a while. And then they just began to roll out with a greater frequency. I went kayaking in the Sea of Cortez and was intrigued by an indigenous group called the Comcock, or the Seri Indians, who are some of the last hunter-gatherers who don't practice agriculture of any place in North America other than Alaska. And now, 55 years later, I have a cabin that we've rented for over 30 years in their villages to help on collaborative projects. And so part of the year, I'm immersed in another culture where there's usually no other Anglos in that fishing village. And to be, I don't want to say a minority, because that is kind of a trope that has some perils to it, but to be able to immerse yourself in a world where people see, smell, hear, and think about the world very differently from you is just the most constant blessing of my life that has opened my heart up to many things that would have gone unnoticed, ignored, or dismissed.
I want to have you talk a little bit about, it's a chapter called Walking Prayer. I'll just read a couple of quotes from you. Solitary walkabouts have invariably revitalized my spirit and helped me heal emotional wounds. And around the time Laurie and I turned 50, we found ourselves motivated by a simple question: what could we do to engage more youth, especially indigenous youth, in healing wild places, along with their own broken or diseased bodies? And you mentioned that years before, you had arranged for a handful of Native Americans to join you at a fitness center in southern Utah. So you arranged for, I guess, walks, pilgrimage with these youth?
Yes. We did one of those Native foraging walks in southern Utah one time down by St. George with just a small group of us. And then when my partner Lori and I came together, both of us had worked with trying to help people avoid or heal from adult onset diabetes in indigenous communities where it's really taken a toll. And we thought that if we did a long-term walk with youth, a 10-day walk, 250 miles across the border with groups of youth from both sides of the border, it could be a change-making episode in their own lives. And oddly enough, it changed us just as much. And so most of the way for those 10 days, we either wild foraged or we had arranged with communities at every point along the way to go out and forage and hunt for foods, most of which are protective of our metabolism so that we're less vulnerable to diabetes, and that were absolutely delicious and healthful in every other way. And there were prayers with every meal in indigenous languages and songs while we walked 12 to 19 miles each day. And I think all of us felt transformed. I just saw one of the youth that was 12 or 13 when he went on that walk with us. And he says, every year at this time of year, near spring equinox, I remember that walk and how it made me a different person than what I had been before. I had been fatalistic and kind of defeatist. And it just allowed me to broaden my horizons so that I feel I can work with others towards problems in the world, solving those problems. So it was really a cathartic moment in my life where, however much I can't take credit for changing any of the indigenous youth on it, we organized it, but certainly there were many organizers and many parents who set the stage for it, including traditional singers and runners. But what I have to say is they changed me probably more than I changed them. They just opened my heart in so many ways.
What is it, just the walking, or does it need to be community? It didn't need to be what you're doing. In this case,
It's
foraging.
I know you just had my dear friend Terry Tempest Williams on your show to speaking about her book regarding the holy ordinary, but it was very tender little things that mattered so much, like taking care of one another's feet. When you walk through the desert for 250 miles, your feet are like taking care of your car or truck when you're on a long journey. So we would put each other's feet in our laps and bandage them and put salves on them and indigenous tinctures and teas, and then the really the kids that had already been on drugs for 3 or 4 years and were having wildly varying blood sugars. We really had to monitor each other's conditions. We weren't just walking along, we were caring for each other the whole way. And that created sort of a collective tenderness across cultures that I just have to say was like this enormous spiritual gift to me that I still cry about. It was just so powerful that to have the good blessing to spend 12 days out in the desert wilderness with people of all ages from 85 down to 12 was just like a miracle that remade me.
At a certain point, you became an ecumenical Franciscan brother. I guess so. First of all, what is that? What do you do, and why did you decide to do that?
Well, the quickest thing I can respond to that with is that I don't try to overtly missionize anyone, certainly not the Indian people who've had 400 years of people trying to missionize them. You'll not read much overt Christianity in the book because the Franciscan mandate is go out into the world and spread the good news, and only when necessary, use words. So there's just absolutely no urge in me to ever proselytize anyone about my way of praying or singing versus theirs. And so I always work cross-culturally. I've most recently been in an dialogue of indigenous leaders in the Vatican about giving legal status to sacred plants, both in the Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Druze, and other Mormonism, of course, everything that some of our politicians still ignore those connections and misunderstand them. But what I'm saying is, I work across faith and between indigenous spiritual leaders and church leaders of many institutional faiths.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about the desert. What is it about desert, do you think, that draws you in? You spend a lot of time in desert.
Well, I love the elegance that comes with something that seems initially empty, but then you realize that everything has its place. Plants aren't too crowded together because they're giving each other enough room to grow, but they're still connected underground. So most of the desert, maybe 9/10 of its biomass in plant roots, insects, microbes, is in the 50 feet below the ground. The desert is deeper than it is higher. And that gives me a lot to contemplate about in terms of understanding life as a whole. It also is a place of extremes. And in some place in the book, I said, this isn't about extremism. It's about being a good extremophile, loving extremes, extreme environments, and what they can teach us. So that's why I go to the raging seas and to the hyper-arid deserts where it gets up to 120 to 130 degrees, both in the North American deserts and the time I've spent in the Gobi, Taklamakan, and the deserts of the Middle East. So we have a lot to learn, especially in times of crisis like this in our own culture, about resilience, tenacity, and how to reduce our stress levels in the face of chaos.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about that. What the desert can teach us? I get resilience, is maybe an obvious one.
Yes, and how to pace ourselves. Most desert plants and animals don't go out during the heat of the sun. If there's a long drought, they reduce their consumption levels rather than lavishly using resources. I think there's messages metaphorically that we can all learn from. And there's sort of a humility. Sometimes desert plants almost look dead for most of the year, the most humble plants on earth. And then when the rains come, the whole world just explodes. Their roots can grow a foot an hour after a 2 to 3 inch downpour. And so the dormant root beds are just sitting there waiting for something to trigger their growth. And I feel that that's a way of responding to the chaos around us right now. We hover, we take refuge, we find refuge for the most in peril, and then we raise our voices when necessary to move for positive change. I am not an adversarial activist. I'm a reconciliatory activist. I walk toward the middle, and I think that's what I've learned about desert plants, that it's not nature tooth and claw. They learn how to partition resources. There's more symbiosis or mutualistic relationships between plants and animals and plants in the desert than nearly any other landscape on earth because they have to. They have to learn how to share resources.
I read this quote at the beginning of this segment. I want to have maybe respond to this. You say, I went looking for water in the desert and found that the world was teaching me how to listen. Maybe you could expand on that. What was the desert teaching you, and how to listen?
Yeah, I would say listen and smell, and we'll talk about that in a second. But by listening, I mean kind of that deep meditative listening where we close down the monkey mind or the ego and our assumptions about the world, and listen to voices that we might not otherwise hear if we're just playing the same old tape inside our head all the time with earbuds on or not. And what I mean is we really have to hit a silence that opens us up to all the other life-generating sounds around us, rather than blotting them out by too much environmental noise coming out of our own heads.
We're talking with Gary Paul Nabhan. His new book is a fascinating book. It's called Water in the Desert, A Pilgrimage. Let's take a brief break. When we come back, we'll have Gary Paul Nabhan read a fascinating passage from his book about smell. We'll have that following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Gary Paul Nabhan, acclaimed ethnobotanist and biocultural conservationist. His new book is called Water in the Desert. And we're talking about that on the program today. That book is out and available now. So, Gary Paul Nabhan, you referenced learning how to listen and also learning how to smell. And there's a wonderful passage from the book, the chapter Synesthesia. I wonder if you'd read that for us.
Yes, and let me contextualize it quickly. It refers at the very start to a traumatic brain injury I had a few years earlier, where I got thrown from a mule and suffered eye and brain impairments. But it also echoes some interest in my very first book, The Desert Smells Like Rain, written in 1982, that I was trying to figure out why the desert smells like rain and whether the rains bring that smell and what it was comprised of. So that's the context. And now I'll read you the piece. It was more than 5 years after my traumatic injuries of cognition and vision, when I could finally celebrate them as a blessing, not a curse. And that happened because of how they allowed the rebirth of a powerful sense of smell that I had had as a child. It gave me a second career as a student of what scientists call the osmocosm and as an aficionado of fragrances. One day while I was walking at dawn with my partner Lori and our Australian shepherd dog Ruby, we were enjoying the bloom of summer wildflowers all around us. Poppies, foreclocks, evening primroses, coyote's gourds, devil's claw and such. I noticed that Ruby had her nose up in the air, sniffing the fragrances wafting in from the southwest. Now, she wasn't just reading the so-called pea mails left for her by the other dogs, gray foxes, and coyotes of our valley. She was taking in other fragrances as if she was prognosticating the weather. The breeze was accelerating as clouds swept into the valley, spilling over the Santa Rita Mountains a few miles away. And that was the moment when everything fell in place for me as to why the desert smells like rain. Lightning appeared on this horizon. Then came the first rumblings of thunder. And as raindrops began to fall, we sprinted towards shelter, where a symphony of smells overcame us. The sweet petrichor of geosmin emanating from the now wet soil crust, the ozone-charged atmosphere carrying 24 more fragrances from the dominant shrubs and understory herbs, which were sloughing off a sheen of volatile oils from their leaves as the rains washed over them. These aromatic oils had been protecting the plants from sunburn, water loss, and heat waves for months and months of drought. But now they were being released into the air in unbelievable densities. I was elated that the monsoon rains had come back to the desert. Ruby, too, was ecstatic, exhibiting the same excitement she gets when she pokes her little wet nose out of the pickup truck window, taking in scents at 50 miles an hour. Turning to look at Lori, I spied joy in her pretty little eyes as well. The desert smelled like rain, but I was puzzled to observe that the creosote bush, the little shrub that I always thought to be largely responsible for the scent of rain, was nowhere to be seen. Still, even without creosote leaves taking the lead in the olfactory orchestra, the band of fragrances played on. For the first time in my life, I realized that floral and herbal scents are seldom admitted by one plant alone, but come to us like a blessing, a symphony, a hallelujah chorus.
That's Gary Paul Nabhan reading from his book, Water in the Desert. Symphony, you used to think it was one note, and now you'd found it's a symphony.
That's right. All the literature on desert fragrances up until that time really focused exclusively on the most widely distributed shrub in North American deserts, the creosote bush from L.A. all the way over to West Texas and Big Bend and way down all the way to Mexico City. And yet we were missing the fact that that should have been obvious, that the rains don't smell like the creosote leaves when you put them up to your nose or take a bite from them and put them in your mouth. They have about 12 to 25 different volatile oils that are coming from as many as 30 different plants in any desert landscape. And so they really do form a symphony, or at least a jazz band, where each little plant is riffing in its own way and releasing its volatile oils that are packed with fragrances at their own pace, in their own density, and in their own style. So it's really like a jazz band more than an orchestra in ways.
I just want to read this. You say, as someone who has struggled with social communication via speech and body language for decades, I find it a deep and lasting comfort to become party to the many conversations within reach, ones that can still be absorbed by smell and taste. I'm now returning to places I thought I once knew. And you say you sniff fragrances of wintergreen and cotton candy that return in full force as memories. That's another part of this, isn't it? Just odor with memory.
Oh, yeah, I've just, after I get a book done of nonfiction, I either write short stories or poetry, and I've just read 70 poems about fragrance and spirit. And some of them are funny, some of them are overtly religious, but mostly are about the many ways that smells trigger memories. My mother, for instance, he had almost a preternatural sense to link smells with tragedies in her life. And I won't go into those tragedies, but sometimes she was picking up a smell that our relatives were endangered from miles away, that their house was burning down, and would remark on that before we got the first call from our relatives into what was happening to their house. And so I can't explain that rationally, but I think we underestimate how much smell triggers memories that guide us in each of us in a different way in our own lives.
Just a couple of minutes left. I just wanted to treat this briefly. That touched me. I'll just read the portion of this. Unfortunately, you say, I can no longer respond to the loss of springs or their species as if they are abstractions. This is the chapter on oases, I think. After a half century of fieldwork observing the desiccation or destruction of places, plants, and others I live, each additional loss is registered not just in my brain, but in my heart. And then a little bit later in the book, you talk about going to look at the results of restoration work you and others have been trying to do in the Colorado River Delta. In this case, successful in places. Tears stream down your face. So I wonder if you talk about that here in the end, just a minute left. You hit your heart, not only your head.
Well, yeah, and I should say that I am not responsible for that restoration that my friends have done in the Colorado River. I was in early discussions about it. But most of the last part of the book is not about any achievement that I accomplished, but these collective actions that groups of friends and colleagues and I did to reverse the destruction in the world. And spring habitats in Utah, Arizona, Texas, and Southern California are among the most endangered habitats in the world. Coastal wetlands are right behind them. And so these pockets of moisture are the wellsprings of biodiversity and deeply important to the spiritual ceremonies of indigenous peoples and even Mexican-American Catholics in our region. And I have no understanding why we've never highlighted the need for conserving the freshwater springs in desert lands the way tropical ecologists have said, save the rainforest. Once you've been around any desert spring, it is no longer an abstraction. You intrinsically feel the way it's life-giving and regenerating and critical to everything for miles and miles around it. And we're losing springs in the desert faster than any other kind of habitat in the world, except for maybe coral reefs. And so we need to get over our amnesia, wake up and smell the flowers, and most of the flowers are in these desert springs. And what I'm saying is we need a kind of conservation that is based not in our heads, but in our hearts, spirits, and bodies, that we've dunked ourselves in those springs and we've tasted the water. I've baptized my children at springs that are now imperiled by the groundwater pumping at the wall that's using, taking 714,000 gallons per square mile to build footers for a border wall that's not needed. And we really have to not have conservation as an abstraction about it's a nice thing to do for future generations, but it's the vital to the health and well-being of the many cultures in our region today.
Well, we've been talking with Gary Paul Nabhan. The new book is out and available now. Fascinating read, Water in the Desert. Gary Paul Nabhan, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so great, Tom, to have me on. And the whole string of people you've interviewed over years are like the heroes and saints of my life. So just blessings to you for all the good stories you've generated by the way you interview us and your own intelligence and heartfulness. Thanks again.
Well, thank you. And thank you for your wonderful work. We've been talking with Gary. Thank you.
Feelings mutual, buddy.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Gary Paul Nabhan, such a pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.